Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, a podcast from the Book Report Network, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. We know authors cannot travel everywhere, so we want to bring them to you, wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Elizabeth Berg. She's written 32 books. Among others, you may know her for her novels, including the story of Arthur Truelove, Open House, and Oprah Book Club selection, Talk Before Sleep, The Year of Pleasures, as well as the short story collection, The Day I Ate Whatever I Wanted, I want that day, Durable Goods and Joy School were selected as ALA Best Books of the Year. Today, we're going to be talking about her memoir, I'll Be Seeing You. So welcome, Elizabeth. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Carol. I like your French pronunciation too, memoir,
of course, very exotic. So what made you decide to write this memoir now?
Well, when I was going through what the book describes, I didn't intend to make it public. I was just trying to keep track for myself of all the things that were going on, not only practical things about what did we say about when we were going to do this? And what were their feelings about wanting to move to another place and not wanting to move? And who was on this side and who was on that side? And also just to get out some of the confusion and frustration and grief, a whole tangle of emotions that comes about when you're in the middle of this situation. Later, it occurred to me, one of the things that helped me most when I was going through this is hearing stories from other people mm-hmm. about the things they were going through. So maybe this could be helpful to someone. And I didn't want to hold back. I wanted to be really honest about everything, including my own bad behavior.
And I think you judge yourself very harshly at times, but I think that it is very real about the way people will feel. You know, years ago, Alison Pataki was very young and her husband went through a medical crisis. And Lee Woodruff, wife of Bob Woodruff, reached out to her and said, write everything down because you won't remember it the same way later. Your memories will be tainted along the way. So by keeping those notes, it's not like, oh, remember we told mom and dad that? No, this is what we were saying at the time. And then 3 months later, this is what we could say to move the process along.
Yeah. Yeah, because it really changes. It's in my experience, it is anything but linear. Mm-hmm. It just is all over the place all the time.
And if I remember correctly, your mom passed away in, was it 2015? Did you need time after that to some distance to give this some perspective as you were putting it together?
I didn't, it's just the way it happened. As you know, it takes a long time for a book to come out. Once you turn it into your publishing house, various lengths of time, if it's some pressing book of the moment, they can get it out pretty quickly. But normally it takes at least a year mm-hmm. for a book to come out. So that was built into it. It was ready to go long before it was published.
And so you were making this little diary along the way. But at the same time, when your dad passed away, I think it was 2012, your mom had 3 years alone. Mm-hmm. And the book sort of, we get some picture of her. But what was it like for her after that? Because he was, during his later years, he wanted her there all the time. He wanted her with her, which was such a huge burden to her. And it's something that when you're 17, you want your boyfriend to be around like that. When you're first married, you want that. But now there was absolutely no freedom for her. So mm-hmm. what happened to her in those ensuing years? Did she feel that level of, I can breathe again?
I think she did feel that at first. I think it was, look, they had a long marriage and a pretty loving marriage that was fraught with difficulties just the last few years. Mm-hmm. Because it was so difficult at the end, there was, at least initially, a great sense of relief for her. But after that, I think that, as predicted, she missed him more than she thought she would. Mm-hmm. For one thing, she was the sun and the moon and the stars to him. And he took care of her. She took care of him too in the stereotypical ways. But he gave her a kind of psychic lift and I think sense of safety that she probably underestimated. I'm just making this up. I mean, that's how I felt it and observed it. She was a pretty private person, not one to easily share her thoughts and feelings. But it seems to me that she did make some friends, but I think that she was sometimes bored and lonely. And she did tell me at one point, it's like the song, I'm tired of living and scared of dying. Mm. And at another point she said, I just feel so weary. And then oddly she said, do you know what that means, weary? And I thought, why is she asking? Of course I know what weary means, but I think she meant it on a whole other level, that this weariness was so profound. And that's not something I came to understand until later. I'm still understanding more things about what happened.
You know, I think it is too. It's, you miss having somebody to do nothing with, as opposed to somebody to do something with.
Yeah.
Always knew he was around. I mean, I have a friend who lost her husband years ago, and she said, this is what I miss, sitting on the couch with somebody, not necessarily talking or whatever, just knowing that there's a companion nearby. And I feel like for years, your mom just knew he was there.
Right.
Yes, there were things that made her crazy, but he was there. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it can be a real clanging kind of loneliness that people experience when they lose a spouse. And I hoped that one of the things that would work against that would be her living in a place where there were other people to talk to if she wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was true. That was one good thing about her being there.
Yeah, going out and make new companions and things like that. Was it hard to write about the painful moments? Because there were, where you were trying to make decisions. And I just love when you would think everything was done. And you'd leave and you'd get home. And by the time you got home, it's like, no, we're not leaving the house.
Was it hard to write about the painful moments? In that I was not writing for publication at first, I was writing for myself. It was a different kind of pain in writing about it. It was private. But I think that if you're going to do an honest presentation of this kind of thing, then you have to go there. Mm-hmm. I think oftentimes people, for the sake of others as well as themselves, tend to gloss over those very difficult parts. It seems unseemly in a way to reveal such things. And I, indeed, when I decided to publish this, I did worry about that. It's awfully personal.
Mm-hmm.
But my experience thus far anyway is that people welcome that kind of admission. It makes them feel better about their own bad behavior, about their own frustrations, about their own missteps. This is by no means a guide for how to get through this. It's just my story of going through it. I'm no expert. I wasn't then and I'm not now. But there is a kind of solace that can come from just hearing that someone else went through it too. And this was my experience, you know, someone saying to you, so here's what happened to me. And it's so universal, but each experience is so utterly unique.
Mm-hmm. But I also think that by being honest, so many people go through life not telling the truth. Like they're constantly altering history. They're altering what went on and whatever. And as a result, when somebody does say, this is the way it was, there's the good times, there's the bad times. It's refreshing because so many people have, I mean, especially with social media these days. I saw someone in a parking lot the other day. I was at a farmer's market and the child was screaming. And I was like, will that make it to social media, to the mother? I said, because no one ever cries. No one's ever unhappy. And I think when people are going through this with their parents, it's almost a private experience that they share some with their friends, but they don't share everything. And I think for your giving so much, it definitely gave me perspective on these are the things that people go through. How can I be more supportive of my friends? How can I think more when my parents go through these kinds of situations? Because your gut honesty being there, it opened up my eyes of, wait a second, this is the way people might be feeling. And sometimes parents are hiding the way they feel. They don't want you to worry. They don't want you. And one of the things is, you talk about the measure, the great love between your parents, and it gave you a high bar of what to achieve in relationships. Did that have a huge impact on you in relationships through the years?
I would say so. I would say so. Yeah. That and, you know, the first guy I ever loved who ran over my heart with a Mack truck, you know, that certainly affected my relationship.
We all have one of those.
All of us have one of those. Yeah. That'll be my next memoir, right? I think that however subconscious it might be, you have a thought in your head when you witness a marriage like my parents that your husband will also adore you in this way, you know? It was a high bar.
And I love what you said.
Different time, you know, it was a different time too. I think that I've heard from people who say, I know what you mean about that marriage. My parents had a marriage like that too. And in the times of, you know, I grew up I was born in 48, so I grew up in the 50s, and I witnessed I witnessed those stereotypical roles being played out, and then the culture changed so much, and women's rights and what we expected women to be able to do, and it got very different. And there was my mother still delivering my dad's dinner to his TV tray at a time when we were all burning our bras and saying, tell him to get it himself, you know, which she did come around to, by the way. That was so interesting that at 88 years old, I think it was 89, he said, do we have any of those sundaes, you know, those little turtle sundaes, individual ones? Rather than leaping up and getting him one, she said, yeah, go get one if you want it. This was a revelation for her.
She had lived the Donna Reed years.
Yeah.
Like, he's home. Everything's perfect. The house is perfect. She did all her chores during the day so she could be there for him. It was very, very much the time. It was, you know, very, very much. And at the same time, then you've got writing about your mother losing her sister, which was very, very sudden. It was somebody that I think was a confidant to her. It was her escape clause kind of a thing. If she left the house, it was with her sister. They would do fun things together. They would have adventures together and all that kind of stuff. And what it also shows her, that loss of how little time is left, because that happened so quickly. And all of a sudden, I lost my compadre. And it's, I think she starts playing this little film in the back of her head about, well, wait a second, I could lose my husband too. So this is what's going on.
I think that was such a tragedy for her to lose her sister, Tish, at the time that she was going through this other transition. As she put it, Tish was the one I bitched to, and she bitched to me. Mm-hmm. And she had another sister, too. Actually, there were six of them, but then one by one, of course, they died, and then there were three left. And Tish was the one with the driver's license, so that was like being prom queen, you know, head of, you know, NHS. And so when Tish could no longer drive, that was the beginning of the end. And then, of course, these complications ensued from a broken arm, and she died. And my mother was just knocked out by her grief, which translated to a lot of anger and despair. So if that had not happened, and Tish had been there to come and pick her up, to go out, I think it would have been a much easier transition. Mm-hmm. But that's what happened. It was such a load that was dumped on my mom.
Mm-hmm. And it was her outlet. It was fun. It was somebody you could just go laugh with and, you know, joke around and things like that. I'm a huge Simon and Garfunkel fan. And I did love the line that you were over there playing their music and she was calling her Simon and Garfunkel and that was annoying you. And I was like, Elizabeth, I would have been the same way if my aunt pulled that off with me.
That was the boyfriend that broke my heart, by the way, you know, and that was our song, and I would listen to it over and over again. I had to move and leave him behind, and she didn't cotton to that kind of melodramatic acting out. She was wonderful, Tish. She was wonderful. She was really funny and strong and very interested in life and in you, and everybody adored her. But yeah, she got after me.
But remember, when we were younger, there were no headphones. It's like they could be playing the same song. My son could be playing the same song all day long. I wouldn't know. Because it was this album, you could just keep hitting the track of Kathy's song over and over and over, and she would know what you were doing. Now everything's a lot more hidden on what to do. You know, it's, yeah. I just love that irked you, because I said, that would have irked me too. That would have been a big problem. You know, you see so much good in the things that your parents did. Things like you didn't know about all the donations that they made. You print this whole list of all the things that you just didn't know that they were doing behind the scenes. And they set a really high bar that they didn't talk about. It was just who their wives were. Did seeing little things like that change who you thought they were? Because all of a sudden it's like, wait a second, you were doing all this, you were not wealthy, but this is something that meant so much to you, these different charities that you would go and support.
Yeah, it just broke my heart how good that was, mm-hmm. how good. They weren't wealthy. And they gave to so many places, and I knew the reason behind some of the places they gave to, but others were a surprise to me. But it might not have been a whole lot of money. Maybe it was $5 or 10 or whatever it was. But multiply that by the number that they gave to, mm-hmm. and also the magazines they subscribed to. I mean, it was very innocent seeming and very dear to me to see that list of things. My sister did that because she's meticulous with record keeping and budgets and so on. But it was a revelation to me.
And you saw things that matter to them enough to A, subscribe to have the magazines come to the house, or B, make a donation towards, where you were physically writing a check. It's not like clicking a button like we do today, just because it's super simple. And it's sort of like the measure of a person that you don't know about. And then all of a sudden you're looking and you're like, these are my parents. This is a lot of what their story was right here. I found that fascinating because you don't really think about it.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't, and I think this is true of many of that generation. They just didn't brag about stuff like that. You know, they didn't talk about themselves. And that was something I grew up with. And something I share with a lot of my friends who say that the message they got was, who do you think you are? You know, just don't be talking about yourself too much and don't be bragging about yourself. And I often say when I go on tour and, you know, people are asking questions and I'm talking about myself, that I'm just waiting for my mother to come and stand at the doorway and say, well, don't we find ourselves interesting? Maybe you'd like to let someone else say something about them. It's always in me from the modesty that they displayed.
Well, you know, I know during the pandemic, my father is very upset because at church, people are not, you know, contributing. They're not putting any money in the basket. None of that is happening. And he's like, how are they going to survive? And a time where a lot of us are thinking about restaurants, a lot of us are thinking about these other things. He says, I have to make sure I'm donating money, because it's very important. How will they keep the school running and all these kinds of things? And to hear that perspective of something that really matters, where somebody, younger people may just dismiss it as, oh, well, that's not something I really need to worry about. I need to support XYZ right now.
Yeah.
And I think that very scrupulous in what they care about. And I think that that's something that can often be lost.
Not only that, but yes, we're going through extremely difficult times right now, but so did they. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they moaned and groaned about it so much. I think we're doing, I can speak for myself anyway, a fair amount of moaning and groaning about this. It's helpful for me to think that there will be an end point. Mm-hmm. We don't know when it will be, but we know that it will be there. And that in some respects, this is an example. this Zoom call. You know, I've been doing, I do an author series where I invite people who make beautiful sentences to come and speak. It's called Writing Matters, because for me as a reader, that's what matters most, is the writing. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't do it anymore. And it was great. It was in a beautiful place. We had flowers, we had food, we had wine, we had music. And now we can't do it. So we've begun doing it via Zoom. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, it's been better, because mm-hmm. people come from as far away as New Zealand, Australia, you know, and over in Europe, and people from out of state who never would have been able to attend before, but now they can. Mm-hmm. So that's an advantage. And I think that my parents would be the kind of people who would more celebrate that kind of thing than complain about what they didn't have, you know, and that they would work together, you know, people would work together, not against each other. I think we're all so exhausted at the fighting and the divide, and, you know, we really can do better than this. And I look mm-hmm. forward to that.
I agree with you. I agree with you, because, you know, this is bad right now, but it's not like your son's being called off to war tomorrow, or your daughter
right.
at this point.
Right.
It's not happening like that. It's not like you don't know. Okay. Somebody might not be coming home for Christmas, but they're home someplace. They're home, you know, somewhere, you know, what's going on. And I just feel like right now, this is a moment, but there are moments, I agree with you, about the way people are connecting. We started doing this monthly series called Boca Chino Live. We're not doing it in December, but we've done it every month. And we actually presented your book that way to readers. Because what I felt like is, if you can't get to the bookstore and you can't get to the library, how can I tell people what's out? So I can sit there and talk about, put a slide up and talk about these books. And people were loving it, because they said, wait a second, now we're learning about the books that are coming out, that if we can't get there. So I think people are making twists and changes of what
mm-hmm.
to do.
Mm-hmm.
To have dinner with their friends. Yeah. And they both set it up. And at least you're conversing. I said, imagine if we were going through this and we didn't have Zoom, which we didn't know what it was in March.
I never see my grandchildren in Boston. It's heartbreaking enough that I can't hug them, you know, but at least I can see them.
And they could sit and have a conversation with you about what they did after school, or this, that, the other thing. That
school.
What they did at the other table before they came over.
Right. Yeah. No, and there's Zoom fatigue. I know that. But
that is.
Recognizing the fact, the countless, nearly countless number of lives we have lost to COVID,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We are still not, as you say, sending young men off to war, or having them in another country where we
don't know what's going on. We don't know what's happening. And, you know, it's funny, because in some ways the children are connecting, things are happening, and they will remember this time no differently than the parents remember going through World War II and sitting in a bomb shelter, or they remember sending their brother off. It's a moment in time. And how you get through these things shows some kind of resilience. And your parents, my parents, they have a lot more resilience about things. They lived through the Depression. They lived through all these things that we understand the market going down. We don't understand real, like, you know, what was happening now. Bad as things are now for a lot of people, and I'm not discounting that at all, it's not the entire mood of the country of, we at least have a possibility of a vaccine. We at least have a possibility that this will, you know, resolve at
Absolutely.
Some point.
Absolutely, yeah.
They weren't sure, you know?
Yeah. And I think that attitude of forbearance was in my parents for the situation they found themselves in. They weren't going to whine and complain about it. And my dad in particular, who was, in his words, losing it. Mm-hmm. He didn't have an awareness particularly of everything that was happening to him. And when he was, for me, one of the most poignant moments in the book is when he went to the VA to get tested.
Yes, I was just going to bring that up. Yes.
Yeah. And just my dad was such a mighty and terrifying presence in many ways. He was a lifer in the Army, and he was really fierce. And every boy I dated in high school was scared to death of him. you can believe I got home on time. But he got very gentle, really. And he had an awareness that he was getting things wrong, or that he had forgotten things, but he just took it. And it was heartbreaking for me to witness that. He was also, you know, in addition to being terrifying, he was really an intelligent man. Mm-hmm. So when I think one of the things I learned to do was to really embrace these small moments of triumph. So when he took the tests that were administered to him at the VA one day, it was in different areas of competency. And the therapist who administered the test was adding it up on her calculator. And before she had even finished entering the last number, he gave her the answer, because he did in his head. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yes, you know, that just kind of made my day.
You got
and
it.
That's what happens. You know, your life gets smaller in some respects, and you learn to have a great deal of appreciation for seemingly small things. They just come to mean so much.
And I love how many of the answers he did get right.
Yeah.
Things that you're just like, wow, that was really great. Dad, go score, you know? And it was, but he realized he's losing, you know, at the same time, that leaving the family behind is such a hard thing for older people. And you quickly see what matters and what doesn't as you're going through that process. And you capture your parents vacillating of, should we go? Should we stay? What are we leaving behind? It was like you were watching a seesaw, I felt, going up and down, and who was going to jump off at any moment? Because it's like down, and she's going to jump off, and then he's going to go flying back the other way. And I just felt like it was so much happening there. But then when you do, well, wait a second, if I couldn't see my hydrangeas bloom, how would I feel? If I couldn't see my peonies come up, and all of a sudden you're seeing there what they're going through your eyes. And I thought that was so beautifully done.
Yeah. I think it's both painful and helpful if that happens to you, because it makes you more empathic for what they're going through. And in the way that I told you, I'm still learning even after all this happened. I guess if I had it to do over again, I would recommend that they go to an apartment somewhere, a condo somewhere, not a place with just older people, and certainly not as conservative a place as they ended up. My mom was a staunch Catholic who went to Mass every Sunday, and my dad, not so much. You know, he went on Christmas and Easter, and she had a deep and abiding faith, but she was not quote unquote religious. And the people with whom she lived in the building she went to were always quoting Bible verses to her. That was not her. Nor did they have very good programming in place. There was nothing about current events. You know, they had bingo, which my mother found totally humiliating. I kind of liked it, but I would think harder or talk to them more about what it is that they didn't know. I mean, it was so confusing and everything had to be done quickly. And so we did the best we could under the circumstances. I will say it was a very comfortable apartment, quite spacious. They had as much room there as they did in their house, and it was all on one floor. So that was good. But I think people do better generally living among all different kinds of age groups, as you do in a neighborhood. So there was a little daycare place attached to where my parents lived. And in fact, my mother could have gone there and read to children. She loved books and she loved children. And she just never got it together to do that. That might have been something that helped her. But by the time she had the time to do it, things had gotten worse for her health-wise too. But there's something about having your own place and seeing people of different ages who do different things, and it makes your life richer, I think, than to have all the same segment of population living together.
I think that's a really good point, because I think that people say, oh, everyone is going to want to go to bingo. Everyone's going to, if your mother never wanted to go to bingo, she's not exactly going to want to go to bingo now. You know, do they have an intellectual book group? And I know you were saying, well, you know, who are the speakers? Who is going to come in? What are the activities? Where could you go on the bus? Like, where would they take you? Yeah. And would it be stimulating enough to do? And I think that when people think about a place, you think about a place, well, you're not thinking about the community in quite the same way. It's like, yeah, you know, who are you, it's like when you downsize your home, a lot of my friends are downsizing right now. Where are you going to make new friends? I always think about that, because it's harder to make friends as you get older, and it's, mm-hmm, you might be living next to people that you really don't like, but it's a different experience when you're older and you're not going to have your kids in school or all these other places where you can meet people. It just all changes. Yeah.
Well, Tish, the sister I referred to earlier, did live in a condo where there were all different kinds of people living there, and she lived in a really interesting and busy part of St. Paul, Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So she could come out her door and go for a walk and go past stores and restaurants, and she would walk up to the cathedral, which is just the cathedral in St. Paul is just breathtakingly beautiful. I don't care how many times you've been there, it's just astonishingly beautiful. So she would walk up there every day and walk back. And as she got older, she would need to stop and rest. But she had that option, whereas my parents did not. There was nothing really in walking distance. There were buses that could take my mom to her beloved library. Mm-hmm. There were buses that would take them to concerts and to shows or out to dinner. But my mom had a problem with my dad going out to dinner with her. She was embarrassed by, mm-hmm, his inability to read the menu, his failing to connect with people, or maybe repeating the same thing or whatever it was. She never did get over that hump, so to speak. She never could understand, Mom, everybody here has failures of, you know, right, that's what happens. I mean, I'm saying it to myself now. You get older, you start, it's not the time of acquisitions anymore. It's the time of losses. So, you know, he's not the only one. And in fact, what happens is that people become compassionate, mm-hmm, with each other about things like that. But she never quite got there. So the activities that were available to her by bus, she did not really use. After my dad died, she finally stopped going to the grocery store she used to go to, which required my sister bringing her there. And she took the bus to a store she could go to, and she came to really like it. So all these things take time at a time when your parents don't have a whole lot of time left. Mm-mm. And if you, right, complicate it with the enormous sense of grief my mother was feeling because of her sister dying, it's a really tough road.
It's a lot. It's more complicated than just where you're living. It's who you are living in that place and how your life has changed, your spouse too. You know, growing up, you lived in a number of places. So you think your mom and dad were used to change. Like if I remember correctly, you moved around a lot. But was it leaving the last home that made it so tough, because it was like the end of that portion of their life?
I think that was part of it. But I think also that after having moved so many times, when they got that house in 1966, my mother said, finally, I'm home. And it was their first home. You know, they'd never owned a home before. So it was really special to them. And I think my mother got there and thought, I never have to move again. Mm-hmm. She did have to move again.
And that one last time. Did the constant moving make your family closer because you were always together?
The one No. People you knew?
No.
No. We, but, you know, the moving, for other people, it might have made them closer. They might have talked about it, about what the kids were feeling when they had to be yanked from yet another place and be the new girl in school. And we didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. That was not supported in my family. You know, you just suck it up and do it. So no, it was definitely a way of life. It fostered a kind of restlessness that is in me still. When I'm in a place for more than 3 years, I kind of start tapping my foot and thinking, okay, where are we going next? I've been in this house now for 20 years, so that's a really big deal for me.
It's a long haul there.
But when you're an Army brat or you know, military service of any kind, brat or ambassador, or whatever, you get used to moving that much. It becomes a way of life.
Mm-hmm. Make new friends quickly. You know, this book is about the aging scene through eyes of daughter. Did you think about your own later years as you were writing it?
Sure. Yeah.
I was thinking, oh, wait, look at that decision. Would I do that one? I'm not sure.
Yeah. And I think about it now. I mean, you know, I have a pretty big house that I don't know how much longer I'll feel like managing. And I think, you know, something really quite wonderful happened with this book, which is that both my daughters, who are age 40 and 45, read it and came to a deeper understanding of my parents. I was afraid for them to read it. I thought they'd say, why are you saying these bad things about grandma? But they came to a deeper understanding of my parents' life and by extension mine. Mm-hmm. And I think it brought them closer to me. So I'm deeply grateful for that.
Yeah, and they can understand like what you were going through, because you were going through this whole process and you're sharing it with them, but they're not really understanding. They're not really understanding what's going on. They're at a different point in their lives. And it's right. Like, oh, mom, like, how can you complain? You know, it's just very, very difficult. How old are they in the picture on the cover? Were they married at that point?
20. That's the day they got married. Uh-huh. I think she was 21 and he 22. They're so young. They're
so young.
Heartbreakingly young. And there's my father being so fierce. Look at him. I'm going to be fierce.
Yes, yes. You know, it's really funny. When I was writing notes for this, I kept calling it, I'll be losing you instead of seeing you. And yeah. Because the whole time she's getting ready to be losing him, and she's losing him so much. And it was so funny because I was typing this and I was like, wait a second, that is not the name. And I know, you know, but the words come from the song, you know, but it was very interesting because to me, the loss was, besides that she's seeing him, it's that he's slipping away and I see myself losing you. So it was just a very strange thing that I saw, you know, even though I'd read the book, saw the title, totally grasped, but I saw that as well.
But it's both. If you're mm-hmm. if you're losing someone, whether it's to Alzheimer's or old age or cancer, I lost a very good friend to cancer at 44. Mm-hmm. You are seeing them even when you're losing them, because you're revisiting memories and you kind of have this double exposure sometimes of seeing them as they were versus as they are, and it's heartbreaking, really hard mm-hmm. to reconcile. But you are still seeing them, and after they die, you see them still. And that was one of their songs, and it was played at my dad's funeral, and it nearly did me in. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful song. If you don't know it,
mm-hmm.
find it and listen to it. Even Ella Fitzgerald's version of it, or Billie Holiday. Oh my God, the lyrics are so beautiful, and I think we're so true for them.
Yeah, it's just like these amazing moments. It's because you can't just capture this so much. And, you know, you also talked about losing your friend. I lost a friend when we were in our 30s, and it was quick. I mean, it was really quick. She was sick for 4 months, and that was it. And it changed my life. I actually left the company I was at after I had my second son. I started this company because I started to see I didn't want to be doing that for the rest of my life. Like, it was great. I was a Condé Nast. I had a wonderful life. But all of a sudden, you rethink. Because you're seeing, and I saw she had a very powerful job there. And all of a sudden one day her desk was empty, like her office was empty. Somebody else moved into it and life went on. And I started sitting there thinking, do I want my life to go on being that, or do I want to do something else? I didn't know what the other thing was. I hadn't made it up yet.
Yeah. But
when you talked about your friend, I was relating to that so much, because those friend losing at those times in your life just make you sit and question, like, where am I doing and where am I going and what's happening?
Right. Yeah, well, you know, I was a nurse for 10 years too. So I had a pretty good understanding of the fragility of life. And I had a pretty good understanding of what it is that matters to people most. Mm-hmm. And it's not the big fancy job, you know, mm-hmm. it never mm-hmm. is. So that helped me in my life and continues to help me in my life. And it also, it was hard to look at losing my parents objectively, you know, to say it's the great cycle of life. They're lucky they got to live this long. Mm-hmm. That's kind of not what you think about. You think about how it used to be or what you're doing wrong or how it could be done better or so on. So if there's anything that I would hope for people to take away from this book, it's don't do that. You know, relish the here and now with them as much as you can.
Yeah, just enjoy it. Just enjoy it and stop overthinking.
Yeah, there's a, you can't enjoy everything, but to slant it in that direction, and also to have in the back of your mind that it is the great cycle of life, that mm-hmm. your turn will come, and you know everything you see around you is not here permanently. So mm-hmm. that's cause for being appreciative and celebrating what you can.
Enjoy every moment. Enjoy, you know, people are saying this year that, you know, they never thought Thanksgiving was a big deal. Like Thanksgiving was a holiday. Yeah. But it was like, oh, I've got to make the turkey and I've got to do this and that. And now everybody's really missing Thanksgiving the way it was. And someone said the other day, I will never, ever take for granted a wedding, any celebration of family. I will never think about quite the same way again. And I'll get myself on more planes and I'll get myself happily to more places. And maybe that's what this is about, learning. Maybe that's what we're supposed to be doing.
One of the things, we should be learning.
Wake up, everybody, you know? So what's the reaction from your family been about the book? You've said with your daughters, you know, were saying, how about your sister? What do they say?
Well, my sister plays a big role in this book, of course. She's the one who lived in Minnesota, and so she was the one who was most responsible for the day-to-day operations, so to speak, of caring for my parents. And when I knew that it was going to be published, or could be, I told my sister, and I said, I want you to read this. And if you don't want me to publish it, I won't. And if there's anything in it that you think I should take out, I'll do it. So she read it and she sent me back an email with two words, all in caps, publish this.
Oh, I love it.
She really was moved by it and appreciated it. I haven't heard from my brother yet. My brother lives in Hawaii and he's a really sensitive guy, and I don't know. He said his wife snatched it from his hand, so she was going to read it first. So I've not heard from him yet. Mm-hmm. There were cousins. I was worried about reading it to his daughter, for mm-hmm. one, and she couldn't have been more gracious. And she said it's hard to write this email with tears in my eyes, but she was wonderful about it.
And you honored her mother beautifully as well. What have you heard from readers? I know it's early, book's not out that long, but what have you heard from readers?
I've heard a lot from readers. I mean, if you look at Goodreads or you look at Amazon or other websites that have, you know, honest, real people reactions, it's astonishing what this has meant to people. And I shouldn't even say this, but I haven't seen a bad review. I haven't seen what I feared, how selfish of her, or how, you know, whatever people might say, has not materialized. I think people are just overwhelmingly grateful to have an honest account of mm-hmm. what this means. And people, even as you did, you know, they are inclined to tell their story mm-hmm. when they read this book, and so it's been a pretty amazingly good experience. Now that I've said that, someone will say, "Well, let me just tell you something. Let me just tell you something about your stupid book." You know,
you can skip that one. Skip that email. Just keep going. Just keep on going. You know, you also narrated the audiobook. What was that experience like?
I narrate a lot of my books because I don't like listening to my own voice, but I don't like listening to someone else's beautiful voice emphasize all the wrong places in so the way I look at it. So I like to read my own books because I know what I want to emphasize in each line. It was in the time of COVID, it was very different. I sometimes Well, I lived in California 1 year and I recorded out there. That was the best recording experience ever in that studio. And I've been to various studios, and I was going to go to one downtown here in Chicago, but I did not want to be, I didn't want to ride an elevator. I didn't want to be in a small space. I was really nervous about doing it. I kept thinking things will get better, things will get better, and things did not get better. So finally it occurred to me, wait a minute, my son-in-law is a sound guy. He does commercials and movies in Chicago and places nearby, sometimes Milwaukee. And I asked him, could you do this in my house? Could you help me record this? So he did. He served as engineer, and he also made a little studio. I have a very small bedroom that's my library, and he made it into a studio. He hung up big things to prevent sound from getting in, and he is such a perfectionist, which I really, really appreciated. So he was in another bedroom doing the engineering. I was in one bedroom recording, and we had a remote director in LA. So we got it done that way, and it was wonderful. I didn't have to go anywhere, and you know, we just had to get rid of the dogs for the day.
This may be for the future. It may be like, wait a second, I don't have to fly anywhere.
Now I've started thinking about that in terms of author tours. Publishers are probably saying, why should we pay airfare, hotel, meals, escort, you know, ground transportation when we can do Zoom presentations? Mm-hmm. Any author can tell you that sometimes when you're on the road, you go out one night and you have 200 people and the next night you have 10. It's incredibly unpredictable what's mm-hmm. going to happen bookstore to bookstore. So I also do a lot of speaking events, all of which I lost, of course. Mm-hmm. And that's different than you usually have a really nice size audience and nice book sales. But it's risky sending authors out on tour. And I think Zoom presentations may become a thing. We'll have to see.
I also think you can reach a lot of people. Like even if you go on tour, I don't care if you go on the biggest tour, you're doing a 20, 30 city tour. It's still nothing of being able to capture around the country. Yes, you don't get to meet the reader up close, but there are other ways that can happen. And I also have heard from a lot of people because we've been doing these Book of Channel Lives, we've been doing these interviews, we're getting to see a lot more authors than we ever saw before. Yes. And we're loving that experience. And we can also watch them on our time. Now look, we had an office in New York. I could go to whatever bookstore was in the city that had an event just about every night of the week. But that meant I got home later. That meant that I had to get there or get back. And if it was a 6 o'clock, how was I going to make it? Or a 7 o'clock, why did I want to wait around? But now the opportunity to be able, there are many times I'll eat dinner and then run up and watch something at 7 o'clock. I saw you a couple of weeks ago on Fiction and Friends. Mm-hmm. And I just said, oh, I'm just going to run upstairs, you know, get to watch Elizabeth and then go back. And then you can do something else. There are nights where I'll do presentations to libraries and I don't have to drive home. I have to walk in the kitchen and have dinner. And there's something really nice about...
Parking. You don't have to worry about where you're going to park.
You don't have to worry about traffic.
Weather. Weather doesn't matter.
And how many times have you gone... Because I used to go to, you know, a lot of the book fairs and whatever, when I either moderate a panel or I'd just be going to cover the events. The flight's late. The luggage isn't there. You've got to get to the hotel. You're sitting in traffic. There's just a lot that goes into it that you just cut out. You just worry about your sound and the look and everything else, and everything else goes away.
And for me, it's been fun. Like we watch a news show called Deadline White House every day, even though it's hard to watch sometimes. But you go to these reporters' houses and it's really fun. I love when John Heilman's Great Danes come into the room and he's petting them and talking about, you know, whatever crazy thing is going on. And I like to see the backgrounds. I just interviewed Sue Miller yesterday for, I do this through the 19th Century Club here in Oak Park. And I really liked seeing her office. Yeah. And that's been a kind of unexpected bonus.
we interviewed Sue a couple of weeks ago, and it was so funny because you are right. It's like, and then I get ideas. I'm like, oh, wow, that looks really great in that house. I should go do that. Look at those pussy willows in the background. They're really good. Mine are over in the corner over there. Should I move them over here? And I also like watch, look, life was very polished for a very long time. It was perfect. Everything was manicured within 1 inch of its life. Newscasters were on, and now somebody's in their house. I also like the cooking shows where they're all cooking at the grill in the backyard and their wife is running the camera. And I think it's real. And I think that as much as these last 8 months have, or 8.5 months at this point, have been horrible in so many ways, there are those moments of sure little joys that happened of seeing people in their natural habitats, as opposed to the contrived ones that everybody seems to live through, you know?
Another lesson to learn too, isn't it? That there's something that's warm and affable about seeing someone not so perfectly groomed and without the stage makeup and all that. I've liked that too.
I like when they do the pullback shot and you realize they're in their basement with a drape around them. You know, it's like, that's really what it is. And there's one guy that I was on NBC Nightly News, and he was always shooting with the bike helmets behind him. And we kept saying, is nobody going to advise him that that's not a great look? And then all of a sudden one night it changed and they're like, oh, they must've gotten a memo, change that look. It's just really fun. You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking of Losing Mom and Pop by Christopher Buckley that came out in 2009. I don't know if you ever read it. I've read a lot of books, and like your book, that will stay with me. And I'm serious, it will stay because there's so many great lines in it. He talked about losing his parents, what it meant, like, you know, first time just losing one and then losing the other one and what it meant. And it were things in it that were like practical, like death certificates. He says you get 25. And this is why. Because all of a sudden the Poland Spring water is going to require one, but the bank is not. And what you need certified notes. And I just read this book and I was like, for this very human knowledge of not just what it was like to lose your parents, but the things like you're writing about in the home of these are the things you want to think about and these are the things you want to do, that kind of writing beautiful writing, like, and also telling that story means so much. So I will tell you that those two books probably will mean the most to me of when I'm going through things with my parents. And it's like that one as well. And it was like, I just had to look up today. It was like 2009, 11 years ago. And I'm still remembering lines from that book.
Wow. Thank you for telling me about it. I'd not heard about it.
Yeah. And I feel that your book, I feel, you know, like exactly the same way. Are there still moments when something wonderful happens to you and you want to go tell your parents? Like, is it one?
Yep. All the time. I think about sending my mom a book or, you know, a recipe I might want to make for them. And similarly, my friend that I lost to breast cancer so many years ago. Wow, how long is it? More than 30 years ago, or something like that. But I occasionally think I've got to call her. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess that's a nice little tribute.
Mm-hmm. It's a little like flashback of, oh, wish I could call right now and tell them this is what happened. It's the immediate call that you make.
Also impetus for you to call a friend of yours who's alive and say, I love you. I just was thinking that. Goodbye.
And it's funny because I've been reaching out to a lot more friends recently because you have more time. And I have one friend who's living out in Colorado, two friends actually, they just want to set up a phone date with to just sit and have some time to catch up because I haven't been out there in a while at this point, but you really feel like I'm thinking of them each day, which sounds kind of crazy, but I am, because I have like more headspace of not sitting on the New Jersey Turnpike. Right. And it's like, you're thinking about, oh, I wonder how they're doing. I wonder what's going on. And social media is great because you can get top line from people, but it's still like, what's really going on out there?
Yeah. Well, I belong to a writer's group. In fact, I relish that group so much. I love those women. I love hearing their stories. I love having them listen to what I've written and critiquing it, and just the regularity of that. And we were already friends, but we've become better friends because of because of that. So yeah, that's, you know, let's put all the positive things we can in our little basket.
Keep packing it up, packing it up. Speaking of which, before you run off to writer's group, are you working on something now?
Yeah, I'm working on a fourth Mason book. Oh, nice. The first book was The Story of Arthur True Love, and that was, to my surprise, it's become a kind of series. I never intended that. But yeah, the fourth one will be turned in, I don't know, maybe early next year.
Terrific. Well, it's been wonderful gathering with you. I will let you go off and chat with other writers. And I appreciate your time today. And I tell you, this is a very special book. I will recommend highly to a lot of friends my age and a lot of friends a little bit younger to just give a look at, to think about what your parents are going through and sort of the challenges you may have along the way with them and how to sort of just say every once in a while, it's all okay. It's going to be all right.
Yeah, it is going to be all right. Yeah, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. And thanks for all you do for books and authors.
Thank you so much. And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from I'll Be Seeing You by Elizabeth Berg, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Recorded Books. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Book Reporter Talks To. You can read more about the author and the books discussed in this episode in our show notes, which can be found on our website, bookreporter.com. There are three ways you can support this podcast. First, subscribe so you never miss an episode. Second, share it or tell a friend about it. And third, rate or review us, as that will help people discover us. This episode is brought to you by the Book Report Network. Thank you to our producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Catherine Koster. And now, hear an audiobook excerpt from I'll Be Seeing You, narrated by Elizabeth Berg.
November 28th, 2010. Three cardinals on the black, bare branches of the tree just outside my window. Nature's ornaments. Now that Thanksgiving is over, Christmas is unleashed like paper snakes from a cardboard can. There are plenty of reasons to despair over the gross commercialism of the holiday, but I confess to loving this time of year. I have put up my modest decorations, and I sit in the kitchen drinking coffee and looking at the little tree I have in that room as though it is Michelangelo's ceiling. I have the radio tuned to the Christmas station and tolerate every single song but the one by the Chipmunks. For Thanksgiving, Bill and I visited my parents. I wanted to look in my father's eyes and see what I could see. So much about him was familiar to me, and unchanged. His blue eyes and the hair raked over his head, and the still formidable width of his shoulders, his chuckle, his leaning forward to hear you better, his head slightly tilted, an expression of such earnestness, such willingness on his face. The cucumbers and sour cream he makes and sprinkles liberally with paprika, stored in their usual spot on the second shelf of the refrigerator, and covered with a shower cap, some freebie from a hotel that works just dandy and saves on the use of plastic wrap. His cache of pill bottles and Kleenex and small screwdriver and pad of paper and pencil with T-shaped, two-headed eraser in a basket at the side of the kitchen table. But, do you want some wine? He asked maybe 15 times in the space of about half an hour, putting the question to Bill and to my mother, both of whom continued to patiently refuse. I don't like red wine, my mother said. I'm fine, Art, Bill said, every time. My father would sometimes tell a story about something I was quite certain did not happen, the type of story that was a reflection of a certain kind of paranoia that was taking hold. And I didn't know whether to interrupt and say, Dad, that didn't happen. It seems like it did, but it didn't. or just sit quietly and listen to the exploits of the juvenile delinquents who like to do things like break into my father's car and sit in there. I elected to remain silent, but all the time I sat listening, a voice inside me was whispering to my father, "No, come back."